720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I always appreciate you for spending part of your Saturday with me. I'm already seeing some really impressive costumes rolling by. We just saw, an inflatable T-Rex running by. I saw a guy in lederhosen running by. I've seen a couple of rainbow mullet wig situations happening. But what I've seen the most of today is lots and lots of Cubs fans, lots of people rocking the Cubby blue today. Of course, we've got the big W flags here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Yes, that's a thing that's happening. Oh my gosh, we got Cubs, we got Halloween, we got all that stuff. And so, you know what? That's some stuff we're going to talk about today on the program. Let's start with Cubs, my friends, because I think we are all hearing a lot about the prices of tickets for the World Series. And, I think we're hearing a lot of it anecdotally, right? I fondly recall hearing a guy, talking about getting a deal on one program, and then you change the channel and you hear a guy talking about paying almost $5,000 for tickets. And so here to talk to us about that is our good friend Danny Ecker from Crane's Chicago Business. Hey, Danny, how are you?
Not bad. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for being with us. I know you have absolutely nothing else going on right now. I appreciate your time. Well, so you've been writing about this and many other sports-related things for Crane's Chicago Business, and we always turn to you for great information. And so you took a really great look at this because, as I said, there's a lot of anecdotal stuff going on. We all kind of have a friend of a friend who paid whatever or tried to get a ticket, but it was this much and things like that. But you really took a look at this number to see what these tickets are averaging. So break it down for us, what you found.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's no joke. I think the best line I heard was these Cubs tickets make Hamilton tickets look like community theater at this point. I mean, this is like, the numbers really are staggering. Before getting to the averages, like walking around the park last night, talking to some of the ticket brokers that had, little setups around the area, standing room only was $2,000. And then if you wanted to have a seat, which was not even a great seat, you're paying $3,500, and that was about an hour before the game started, which is usually when, the brokers get a little bit desperate and they start lowering their prices. But, it was a serious, these are serious numbers. So for perspective, yesterday, the average resale price, we're not talking about asking price, but actually what people are paying, was about $4,400 for game four. So we're talking, that's tonight's game, $4,400. And another $4,400 or so for game five. Those have come down a little bit after last night's loss.
But
we're still talking about, some real serious coin that people are putting in, to buy some of these tickets.
Yeah, no doubt. I wondered about that. I wondered about how last night's outcome may have influenced those ticket prices. But to kind of put this in perspective, when we think about, when we think about ticket prices, The Mayweather Pacquiao fight that was in May of last year, that was an average of about $4,600 for that one. So this is that's like a once in a that was a once a blue moon thing that too. That was a major thing.
Absolutely. I mean, this is on par with Super Bowls. I mean, think about what previous World Series have been. You'll pay $1,000-$2,000 for on average for some of like the biggest games. And these are, mid-series games here. The Super Bowl 50, so that was the Super Bowl earlier this year, mm-hmm. average resale price was $4,500. And the Super Bowl last year was $4,200. So this is actually, at $4,400 around that area for these tickets, even if it has dropped a little bit overnight, we're still talking more expensive than several of the past few Super Bowls before the last couple of years. And then another bit of perspective, you think about the Blackhawks, the Stanley Cup Finals games that were at the United Center in 2015 and 2013, the average ticket price for those was about $1,000, maybe a little bit more than $1,000. So we're talking, three times, maybe even four times what people were paying to see Stanley Cup Finals games at the United Center for the Blackhawks.
Yeah, wow, that's really, really something. And then also we have, the bars around Wrigley. They, what might normally be $5 or $10 for cover to get in, suddenly we're seeing, prices several $100 just to walk in the door and stand at the bar.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And it sort of grew out of during the NLCS, the series against the Dodgers, there were a line 60, 70, 80 people deep trying to get into these bars, and some of these bars didn't even have any cover. You kind of scratch your head going, boy, these bars really should be charging, considering the kind of demand there is to get in, just to be around it. I mean, that was the crazy thing, just to be in the area. People wanted to – it's a magnet, Wrigley Field is, during, you know, during these games, and people want to be – even if it's a bar nearby, it's almost like a consolation. So if you can't be in the stadium, you're really close. You feel like you're part of that atmosphere, and people are willing to pay a couple $100 to get in and stand, or maybe sometimes sit. You know, some of the bar packages too are crazy. People paying, you know, $500, $1,000 for these, you know, unlimited food bar packages. You know, everyone just wants to be in Wrigleyville.
Wow, $1,000. Those better be some pretty good wings for a grand. Wow. Yeah, definitely. And people also, it seems like on eBay, things like that, you have been writing about how Cubs memorabilia, suddenly people are dusting that off and trying to see if there's a market for old Cubs artifacts now that we have this you know, this win maybe in our grasp.
Yeah. It's really kind of interesting to see how, I mean, if you talk to some of the collectors and some of the, you know, memorabilia appraisers around town, you know, when teams do well like this, there's just a little sort of a surge in people who are going and, you know, finding some old Cub stuff that maybe they have in a closet somewhere, or their grandparents passed along to them, or their parents passed along to them, and trying to see, okay, you know, what's this worth? Because there's a premium on it when the team is doing so well and the history comes into play, and you just see a flood of items. Some of them are valuable, and some of the stuff, the gems come out, and then there's a lot of you know, stuff that would, let's say, it's not so valuable, I guess.
People kind of are a saying reach,
that they yeah, you know, trying to get what they can for some of the stuff. But you know, there's that side, and then of course you also have all the, there's people who are putting a lot of money into, you know, the anything that was game used by the current players, like Chris Bryant, Anthony Rizzo. People are paying $3,500, $4,000, even a little bit more than that for a, you know, for Chris Bryant signed rookie cards on eBay. You know, people believe these are investments and that they're going to pay off, you know, 30, 40 years from now if these guys are Hall of Famers and legends of the game. And you know, all signs so far are that they're off to good starts, but it's definitely it makes you scratch your head if you kind of wonder how much money some of these people, collectors, have to throw around for a pair of used pants or a
sock
bat
or something. Right. Well, it makes you scratch your head when you think about all the money being thrown around. It's certainly fascinating to watch, both with tickets and memorabilia. Danny Ecker from Crane's Chicago Business, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a good one. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about those Halloween pop-up stores that are everywhere, right? Everywhere. We see them all over the place, and then they vanish, and then they come right back the year after that. We'll talk about that here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today. I see you all out there running around on Michigan Avenue in all of your Cubby Blue stuff. Everybody is feeling the Cubs spirit for sure, but they're also feeling the Halloween spirit because I'm seeing lots of Halloween costumes. People are getting started early today, that's for sure. I have seen a couple of rainbow wigs. I've seen a T-Rex, a couple of, let's see, a little bit of Lederhosen. There was a princess a minute ago, all kind of stuff. So good times on that one. The city should be nice and calm tonight for sure, with both Halloween festivities and a Cubs game tonight for sure. But, you know, this time of year, there's like a lot of empty storefronts, things like that we kind of forget about. And then suddenly they are bustling with activity, right? Suddenly these Halloween pop-up stores come up and there's a ton of business and then they vanish almost overnight. It's really impressive how seamlessly they get in and get out, really. But here to talk about that with us from Bloomberg is Patrick Clark. Hi, Patrick. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us today on the program. So I think these stores are so interesting because they really do just, you don't see like a build out. It's like they have no time to waste to you know, to make the store, like build it out and fix it up. They just sort of one morning, there's a Halloween store there on your block. And then right after Halloween, suddenly it's gone. And it's very specific to these kinds of stores. But you've been writing about this for Bloomberg. So tell us a bit about what you've learned about them.
Right, and then in the middle of it, there's like giant hordes of people cramming themselves
right
into them.
Right.
It's kind of amazing. you know, they are in part opportunistic in the sense that I think that the pop-up Halloween store really grew during the last recession when there were a lot of retail store vacancies, and you had this tenant here in Halloween stores, and there's a few sort of national pop-up chains, and then probably some local ones at least in bigger markets as well. But they had a business model that made a lot of sense, even, you know, good times or bad. People like to dress up and either go to a party or go trick-or-treating. And so they've been a great tenant for landlords with space. And they roll into the storefront. They do their business for, you know, usually 6 weeks or maybe 2 months, and then they're out, and the costumes go back into storage to be pulled out again the next year.
It's so very, very interesting, and it's really you know, it's been interesting to watch them rise too, because not even that long ago, we all just made our own costumes. Very rarely, maybe at the drugstore, right? There'd be a few masks or something like that. But for the most part, you know, you cut like holes in a sheet and you're a ghost, or you make a princess dress or whatever, you know, you wear all black and you're a witch or something like that. And it's so now it seems like the default, like very few people, I think, take the time to make the costume. That could just be a cultural shift. We have less time, things like that. But I think there's also such an interesting marketing play there, right? Because there's so much of like licensed characters and things like that. And it seems like there's last year there were a ton of little the princess from Frozen, right? There was a ton of those kids running around. And it seems like every year, whatever the big movie is or something like that, whatever the big toy is, that's the costume that goes. But then there's also, you know, I think there's some subcategories that are interesting, right, too, about like the sexy version of whatever. I saw a sexy Ken Bone costume from the debates, right? And then also I think pets are, that's kind of big business too, right? People are, it's sort of like expected that you would dress your pet now, where I think that was very unheard of not so long ago.
Yeah, I feel like this has all played out over the course of my life. I'm 35. I think really, if you go back, Halloween kind of became a sort of nationally kind of important occasion. Probably going back further to sort of the 50s or 60s, Americans are populated in the suburbs. Suburbs are great places to go trick-or-treating. It's kind of custom made, But at the outset, it was, like you say, it was probably mom's, getting out the scissors and sewing machine and coming up with some sort of homemade costume of, you know, depending on, at the level of one's ability. I was blessed with a mother who made pretty good costumes. But I kind of remember as a child, and as a child in the 80s at some point going into a store and wanting not the thing my mom could make, but the scary mask that you could buy. Mm. And the largest chain of pop-up stores is Spirit Halloween, which was launched in 1983 in the San Francisco Bay Area, and was just sort of a guy with a women's apparel shop who was kind of noticing that you could do this kind of business, and he just closed his he put his the dresses and blue jeans and whatever he was selling at storage for a month and sold costumes and then brought the women's clothes back out. But so she sort of, this was a person who recognized this thing in the early 80s. There were other companies, Party City, which is the other kind of major Halloween specialty retailer, which is a slightly different model. You know, they have about 300, I think, this year, a little less than 300 Halloween stores, but then, you know, then they've got 900 or so year-round stores, which come Halloween season, they turn into Halloween stores. So those are sort of the models, but that was a business which started in the middle of 1980s as well. So you've got the sort of two dominant players, both kind of starting along this path in the 80s, but really kind of starting to grow fast in the 90s, late 90s, and into the 2000s. And, you know, if you go back to sort of, if you think about it along generational lines, you've got the, if you assume that people who were born in the 80s or so are sort of the first ones kind of buying the more commercialized Halloween costumes. And I'm sure there were some, you know, some license deals prior to that. But if you assume that the 80s are the time when kids are sort of participating in a more sort of commercialized, less homemade Halloween, well, those kids 10 or 15 years later are in college and carrying on the tradition. And I think that, you know, everyone I talked to in writing this story would say that, you know, Halloween, the further back you go, the more Halloween was just about kids. And, you know, it's sort of, I think, the millennial generation where you start having people carrying on the Halloween tradition later into life. You know, one of the really interesting things in reporting this story is that Halloween's on a Monday this year, and that's not great for the Halloween retailers, whether it's Spirit Halloween or Party City, or even like a Walmart analyst told my co-writer and I that you know, that Halloween sales could be down there too, and that's because Halloween's on a Monday, and the kids will still dress up and go trick or treating, but the adults are less likely to buy a costume because who goes to a Halloween party on Monday night?
Sure. Well, I've seen some people running by the studio this morning already here in Chicago. I've seen a T-Rex. I've seen some lederhosen. I've seen a whole lot of rainbow wigs. So I think we're okay. We might be okay. I think people are going to celebrate it today. It's also, and we've got to go to break here in a second, but it's also interesting that this is a spot that sort of fills a gap for seasonal workers, right, between that summer gig and the holiday retail, right? This is an interesting spot in the middle of it for those seasonal workers. So what does the number look like for Halloween, all of it, for all the costume industry? How big of a business is that?
God, I mean, Party City told us they were hiring 35,000 people for the Halloween season, which is that's a really big number. You know, that's over just under 1,200 stores. And that does not count the people who are employed, you know, designing costumes, making costumes, moving costumes
shipping
around the country.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Spirit Halloween is maybe a tiny bit smaller than Party City, but basically about the same size. And so you know, certainly you can imagine, you know, possibly, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of people working in Halloween retail.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. And we think of these shops as kind of sneaking in and sneaking out. But in fact, all that fake blood and masks, it's really, really big business. Thank you so much, Patrick Clark, for being with us from Bloomberg today.
Have a great day.
Thanks, you too. All right, my friends, let's take a quick break and then get you to news with our good friend Bob Kessler here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for sticking with us today. Always happy for you to share part of your Saturday with us, and always very grateful to you for doing so. My friends, still lots to do. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Cubs here in just a bit, but did you know that if you put a teal pumpkin on your porch on Halloween, it is a signal to trick-or-treaters and their parents that I think is a really cool one? So joining us to talk about the Teal Pumpkin Project is Nancy Gregory. She's the Senior Director of Communications for Food Allergy Research and Education. Welcome to the program, Nancy.
Thanks so much, Amy.
Thanks for being with us. I read about this just this week, this Teal Pumpkin Project, and I think it is so wonderful and inclusive because I have been thinking quite a bit about children with food allergies, and I know more and more kids are being diagnosed with very serious sometimes allergies, sometimes that, you know, that have to carry an EpiPen, some of these things that can be fatal if not treated. And so I've thought a lot about Halloween, so I was delighted to read about this project that you guys do. So tell us about the Teal Pumpkins.
Sure. So the Teal Pumpkin Project is an awareness campaign and really a movement to create a safer and happier Halloween for all kids by, as you said, encouraging households to put a teal pumpkin in front of your home to show that you have non-food treats instead of or in addition to the regular traditional candies that you might have for kids with food allergies and other dietary restrictions. With 1 in 13 kids affected by food allergies here in the U.S., the likelihood that a trick-or-treater coming to your doorstep who has a food allergy is very high.
1 in 13, that is very, very high. You know, and I mean, for a couple of years, I don't get a ton of trick-or-treaters where I am right now, but in past addresses, for a few Halloweens, I've been giving out things that are non-food just for health reasons. I'm that person. I grew up next to a dentist who was like the person who gave out the toothbrushes and toothpaste, and I thought, oh, what a bummer. But now, as an adult, I, of course, realize, you know, the benefits of doing so. But I think things like little glow sticks and bracelets and crayons and stuff like that, it's really fun, and it's just a healthier move. But there, I was particularly moved. There was a story that was written by a parent in Huffington Post about how difficult it is and how grateful she is to see those teal pumpkins, because it's so hard for her to have to tell her child, no, you can't fully participate in this holiday that's really fun for a lot of kids. And when we get home, I have to take half your candy away. You can't have it. And, you know, things like that. And so it's such an interesting and inclusive thing to do, to have that teal pumpkin. But there's also some resources on your website where people can go and download some signs to put in their window to raise awareness of it, too, in case people don't know what that teal pumpkin means.
Right. So on tealpumpkinproject.org, there are a number of resources for you. If you don't happen to have a teal pumpkin, or you couldn't find one at a store, or you didn't have time to paint a pumpkin teal, we have a number of free downloadable signs that you can just print out and show that you have non-food treats. And then we also have some signs, frequently asked questions, and a list of suggested non-food treats. As you said, those glow sticks are very popular. Things like bouncy balls. Last year, I gave out both, and we just recommend that if you are giving out both candy and non-food treats, that you do keep those in a separate bowl, just to safeguard against the risk of cross-contact.
That's a great idea. What other tips like that do you have for people who maybe want to be inclusive but aren't from a household that necessarily has an allergy sufferer in it, but just wants to, you know, help other kids out?
Well, I think that it's good to keep in mind that even some non-food treats might have allergens. So things like molding clay could have wheat. So our list on our website is fairly, it's free of the top 8 allergens. If you do have the 2 bowls, you know, ask the kids what they want. You may find that some kids that even don't have food allergies choose the toy, because we know that they're going to collect a ton of candy on Halloween, and they might appreciate that little trinket or that little toy or prize.
Yeah, I love this. I think this is really wonderful. And how did it originally get started?
Well, it originally started because it was a mom in East Tennessee who's a food allergy support group leader. Her name is Becky Bassalone. And in 2012, she went to a trunk or treat event and painted a pumpkin teal, and that home, later that night, her son put it out in front of their home to show that they had non-food treats. We heard about the idea at fair and absolutely loved it. Talked to Becky in 2014, 2 years ago, about adopting it as a national idea, and we coined it the Teal Pumpkin Project. Shared about it on our social media channels, and we immediately got incredibly positive feedback from both inside and outside the food allergy community. And what's been really exciting to see for us is that not only are households participating, but we're really seeing other places that have Halloween events, shopping mall trick-or-treating events, and museums and zoos that do Halloween festivities incorporate the Teal Pumpkin Project into those events. So that has been fantastic.
Really, really wonderful. I love the work that you're doing. And indeed, there's so much we need to fix with our food system, something we talk about a lot on this program. But this is a wonderful, wonderful thing to do in the meantime so that everybody can have fun on Halloween and that no kids feel left out. So give us the website one more time, because I'm sure there's parents listening that want to be involved in this.
Sure. It's tealpumpkinproject.com.
Wonderful. And again, my friends, there are lots of great resources. I was checking it out this week. There are tons of things you can download and print out. There's lots of FAQ stuff on there, lots of information, and a list of treats of great ideas and lots of good tips, like keeping them in separate bowls, good things like that, good things to know so
right.
that everybody can be safe this Halloween. Thank you so much, Nancy, for being with us today.
My pleasure. Go Cubs.
Right, exactly. Thank you so much. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and then be right back in just a bit to talk about those Cubs here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. So glad that you're here. Joining us now on the program, we've been kind of talking a little bit about Cubs today and a little bit about Halloween, so let's keep that Cubs train rolling for sure. Joining us now is our good friend Hal Dardick, who is a City Hall reporter upstairs at Chicago Tribune. Hi, Hal. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Well, you know, I think the one thing we have not talked about lately about Cubs is this whole thing about the Cubs ownership and the merchants around Wrigley Field, because that is getting rather heated. Just on Wednesday, aldermen advanced a measure trying to really shore up that ban of the sale of non-Cubs merchandise. So what is the latest of with that since the aldermen advanced this measure on Wednesday?
It looks like that's going to be passed by the full council next week. But what they did was enact or change the ordinance, the adjacent sidewalk ordinance that governs how peddlers do business outside Wrigley. And it had been challenged. They passed this thing in 2006. And what it did was it placed a ban on folks who were not authorized by the team to sell goods from selling on the sidewalks right outside the field. They could go across the street, but they couldn't sell where all the big crowds were and where they were going to make the most money. That got challenged in court last year when the city all of a sudden started enforcing it, largely because Tom Ricketts, who, as everyone knows, is investing hundreds of millions of dollars in renovating the field and in development around the field, decided told the mayor and the alderman, if I'm going to invest all my money and you're not going to help me with any tax breaks or anything, I want you to start enforcing this ban. So the city started enforcing it last year, and right away they got sued in federal court by a guy who was selling Chicago Baseball Magazine. And what he alleged was, you're violating my First Amendment rights. The team can sell whatever written materials it wants outside the field, and I can't. As it happens, the courts ruled in the city's favor, said, well, you can go across the street and sell it. You still, have the right to express your opinions in your magazine. But the court raised a couple of other concerns. And one was, okay, you're going to let the Cubs do it and you're not going to let these outside vendors do it. That looks like discriminant enforcement. And the other issue is you're requiring peddlers other than the Cubs to get a peddler's license to sell materials, written materials. That may be a violation down the line when we rule on this of this guy's freedom of speech. You shouldn't have to get this license. So the Cubs changed and said, okay, you don't have to get a license if you're selling written materials. But what they did to protect the Ricketts was, instead of defining where the ban is in effect as sidewalks, they said, well, it's going to be in public ways. Well, guess what? Tom Ricketts and the Cubs own some of the sidewalks outside Wrigley. So that means they can sell their goods and the other folks can't. So it's a way to prevent the city from losing a suit based on indiscriminate enforcement. Of course, we'll see how that goes. I mean, even if Ricketts owns the sidewalks, you still got to question whether that's still a public way or not. And I expect somewhere down the line that will be litigated.
Right. It does seem like an interesting, Pandora's box to get into to start once we define where, what we are calling public right there around Wrigley. I think that's really interesting. But what about, to play devil's advocate a bit. So the vendors that are like, okay, fine, I'll cross the street. I'll just sell across the street. I'll maybe make a little bit less money. But nonetheless, the crowds are still going to have to pass by me to get there. What are the bigger implications, though, of doing this? Is this kind of a slippery slope where this border could expand, or this could impact vendors around other events?
Certainly they could. The city council, if it chose to do so, could, do similar things around other stadiums in the city, United Center, the White Sox ballpark. And although the folks in those areas own more of the land surrounding those places, so that they may be on more solid ground, but they could certainly try and expand it around Wrigley if the Ricketts family wasn't happy and said, there's still too many people making money. I don't anticipate that they do that. I don't see any sign of that, but you never know what's going to happen.
Right, right. It is very, very interesting, especially as that area is morphing a little bit and you know, new things are going into Wrigley and the Ricketts family is putting so much money into that area. It is really interesting to see how this is changing and shaping that area. Well, as we were talking about a little bit earlier on the program with Danny Ecker from Cranes, we were talking about the ticket prices. So I don't know that anyone is really necessarily not making money right now at Wrigley. It seems like a lot of people are making money both on tickets and merchandise, both written and printed, licensed and not. It seems like now is the time. And even people on eBay, there's lots of like memorabilia being dusted off right now. So certainly an interesting time in this city for sure. Well, thank you so much, Hal Dardick, for being with us, City Hall reporter upstairs at Chicago Tribune.
Thank you.
Thanks. Always a pleasure. All right, my friends, that about does it for us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Appreciate you being with us today for sure. We still got a couple of minutes left, but so I have to ask, Griffin, are you doing Halloween stuff now that we've talked all about Halloween, all about that? I mean, I know a dozen people that are just going as Cubs fans. Is that?
That seems pretty
weak.
That's
like the de facto costume right now.
That's a little weak. Well, but you know what? Go forth. I did see some guys, a picture of some guys by Wrigley that were dressed as old-timey Cubs players.
Oh, that's cute.
From like the 1800s, and then they had like ghost makeup.
Ooh, okay.
So I kind of liked that.
That's a fun one. That's a good one.
Undead Cub player or something like that.
I've seen a lot of, on Instagram, I've seen a lot of goat costumes.
Sure. Do you not know why?
No, I know why. Okay. I just feel like
the look on your face.
Well, I just think that's a tender, like an iffy line to walk.
Don't go there.
Yeah, don't go there.
Right.
Don't
yeah.
do that. One of them was standing in front of Wrigley. Don't do that.
I don't mind that, but it just seems like that's part of the Cubs culture that we could do well to be rid of. Like,
yeah, let's
it's all
let
about
that
the
go.
Future now. Yeah, move on.
We're clinging to the past.
But I'm not gonna freak out about it. I shouldn't hate on anybody's costume though, because probably.
I would say this: if someone wants to be a Cubs fan for Halloween, now's a good time to do it. I have every single time I have looked up today on the show, I've seen Cubby Blue running by. Lots of Cubs stuff out there. Right,
but those aren't costumes.
No, well, that's what I'm saying. There's
Cubs
just a lot of stuff. People have like dusted the stuff off, and it's all out there. So it's one of those. You know, it's a good one where you like.
Yeah.
It's one of those costumes where you can just kind of already have it on.
Yeah.
And just kind of.
You're like, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
I don't usually wear this. It's Halloween, right?
I'm going to go stand in Wrigleyville, but then also go to a party. So I'm just going to wear this and it's going to work for everything.
Well, what are you going to do? Anything?
I have devil horns right here.
Oh, yeah, that's
sitting
right.
Here with me.
Forgot about the devil horns. So that works, yeah.
I don't know. I do have a party to go to, and I don't know. I don't know what I'm going
to
wear.
Maybe you'll have to visit a Halloween pop-up shop.
Maybe I will.
That we talked about earlier.
Those kind of scare me a little bit, and then I end up getting mad about the sexy versions of costumes.
Yeah, they're kind of unsavory places. I'm not. I don't usually go.
I mean, I do admire their ability to hop in there and hop out. Like, it's overnight.
Oh, yeah.
There's no sign that anyone has even been there by, you know, middle of November.
That's true. Yeah, there's one right by my apartment, and it's scarier after Halloween when it's abandoned and just looks like, what even goes on there?
Yeah.
And then it's all year. There's nothing else there. It's crazy.
But I'm also, I get, you know, after talking to the reporter today that we had on the program, who said he was, I think he said he was 35, a little older than that. Right. So I guess I'm of that last group that we like made our own costumes. So it doesn't have as much appeal to me as to go buy
a
costume.
Yeah.
I like to make them. And I
get that.
I was also like lucky enough to have a mom who sewed a lot and made beautiful things and was very creative. So, you know, I had some cool. But bless her, I have a memory of her like staying up all night to make a Wizard of Oz costume for me, like Dorothy.
Well, there you go.
Something like, oh man, she logged some hours. Anyway, my friends, whether you are doing Cub stuff or doing Halloween stuff or doing both of those things in some kind of combination, have a safe and wonderful holiday weekend and baseball weekend and all that good stuff. We're going to take a break and get you to news and turn things over to our good friend King John here in just a bit on 720 WGN.